This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J. M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Coming up on this week's Environment Show, the Superfund program was created to clean up the nation's toxic waste sites. But 17 years later, many sites are still contaminated and Congress is calling for reform. We visit a Superfund site in Front Royal, Virginia, where residents are still waiting after 8 years for cleanup to begin. Then we go to Washington, D.C., where policymakers are slugging out the details of Superfund reform. Our ear to the ground finds students spending their spring break working on a denuded cypress swamp in Louisiana, and a portrait of a Navajo sheep ranch in Arizona. And in the Earth calendar, we meet the bees, but no birds, in the apple orchard. These stories and more coming up on this week's Environment Show. 17 years ago, the U.S. government established the Superfund program. The goal was to clean up sites around the country contaminated by toxic waste. But the program has come under fire from everybody, and many sites still await cleanup. The Environmental Protection Agency is the wing of the government responsible for the program. And while it has made significant changes to Superfund over the years, Congress is considering passing a wholesale reform bill. The Environment Show's Thomas Lally looks at Superfund and efforts to reform it, starting in the town of Front Royal, Virginia, home to a Superfund site which remains contaminated 8 years after the site was added to the Superfund list.
This sprawling Superfund site sits on 440 acres at the edge of the small town of Front Royal, tucked away in the rolling Shenandoah Mountains and right along the Shenandoah River. Opened in 1940, this was the site of the world's most advanced rayon plant. During the war years, it pumped out material for many thousands of parachutes and tires. Then in the 70s, Abtex Fibers bought the then-aging plant. Town residents say it had always sent a foul smell over the valley, but in the 80s, the pollution got worse, and the company didn't have the money to fix it. Finally, one day in 1989, Virginia's Attorney General, citing over 2,000 pollution violations, ordered the plant closed. What officials found astounded them. 220 acres of 30-foot-deep lagoons filled with a deadly toxic soup, a 60-acre manufacturing plant with toxins oozing from nearly every corner, and underneath it all, a sewer and drainage system filled with yet more toxins. Today, the site looks unkempt. Weeds rise waist high, and deer congregate in the open meadows. Still, houses surround the site on three sides. Randolph-Macon Military Academy is just up the hill. And from a daycare center, you can read signs on the fence which read, EPA Superfund Site. A couple of miles away from the Abtex site is Front Royal's small downtown. Foster's Jewelers is located right in the middle of Main Street. Fred Foster is the owner and is also heading up the Warren County Redevelopment Corporation. He says the plant's closing and continued shutdown has been devastating for the area.
In its heyday, it had 3,800 people. And it was the largest rayon manufacturer in the world, and I think the largest employer in the state of Virginia in its time, in its heyday. But when it closed, we were like 14 to 17% unemployment in the area, and it devastated the area. It really, I mean, it didn't slow things down. They just came to a screeching halt.
Foster says the community desperately wants the site cleaned, and after $25 million of taxpayer money already spent, he blames the EPA and the Superfund program for not moving quickly enough.
Very, very slow. Too many young people are in the United States Environmental Protection Agency with an inability to make a decision. But I think the problem is they study a study to death, and then they want to go back and take another study to make sure the first study was correct. That's wrong. You've got to sooner or later roll your sleeves up, back the truck up, and say, okay, let's start cleaning up the site.
90 miles to the east of Front Royal is Washington, D.C., where Superfund has been the subject of intense debate ever since the program started. As hundreds of millions of dollars have been spent in its name, efforts to reform Superfund have dragged on for years. Now many believe Congress stands a good chance of passing Superfund reform this year. The two biggest issues are who pays for cleanup and how clean should the sites be. Clifford Rothenstein is the deputy administrator designate for the Environmental Protection Agency. He says Superfund is not perfect, but is fundamentally sound.
Many folks have criticized Superfund in the past, and that was a fair criticism years ago. The program is fundamentally different now than it was several years ago, and that's largely due to Administrator Browner's administrative reforms to try to improve Superfund. The numbers basically speak for themselves.
Rothenstein says EPA has enacted major reforms over the past 2 years, saying that out of the over 1,300 Superfund sites, work is completed or underway at 1,100 sites.
We have turned the corner on Superfund cleanups. Most sites have either completed their cleanups or have cleanups ongoing today. And if we get our budget request, an additional 500 sites total, which would make a total of 900 sites by the year 2000, will have all of their cleanups completed.
Yet even with recent progress, Superfund continues to draw fire from many sides. Velma Smith is the executive director of Friends of the Earth. She says the criticism is often unfair.
What is the most hated environmental program around, and what is the most effective environmental program around? And the answer is Superfund. And that is because Superfund is not only about cleaning up, but Superfund was a program that from the beginning was aimed at changing behavior and creating a chain of responsibility. The overall impact has been that businesses, a lot of businesses, have really cleaned up their act because they see the specter of some very tough liability coming down on their heads in the future.
Superfund is hated because it's costing businesses and governments big money. The law states that all parties, no matter how big or small, must pay to clean up the portion of the mess that's theirs. It sounds fair enough, but deciding who owes what has led to thousands of court cases. Some of the most spectacular cases have involved Fortune 500 companies suing parties like mom-and-pop pizza shops and even the Girl Scouts.
I don't believe for a moment that those suits are about cost recovery and about those companies trying to get a fair share back from those folks. Those suits are about destroying the reputation of the Superfund program. They are about politics and creating a political climate that will change Superfund and destroy the liability scheme. That's what they're about.
Velma Smith and many others believe the solution to this problem is to cut out the smallest of the polluters and only go after the big polluters. But that won't stop the costliest legal battles, which have been between insurance companies and businesses. Both claim the other is liable. Critics point to the huge costs of these and other lawsuits as evidence of Superfund's failure. Clifford Rothenstein from EPA agrees small polluters should not be held accountable, but he says EPA is committed to making sure polluters, and not the taxpayers, cover most of the cost of cleanup.
We're not talking about placing blame on anybody, that somebody was criminally liable. There may have been no laws at the time, but it's a question of who should be responsible to clean it up. Somebody who actually was responsible for creating the contamination, or the public at large who was not responsible. And it's our position that those who were responsible should be required to pay to clean it up, whether it was legal or not.
Time is another complaint of many people. It takes an average of 16 years to get a Superfund site clean. But Friends of the Earth's Velma Smith says it often took a long time to contaminate Superfund sites, and they won't be cleaned overnight.
It doesn't matter what you do with the liability. It doesn't matter how much money you throw at it. Some of these sites will not be cleaned up for decades because it's going to take that long to clean them. They are that bad.
If Superfund reform is passed, it's likely to include more flexibility for cleanup standards, meaning some sites may only be clean enough for industrial uses. Environmentalists aren't particularly pleased with this provision, since remaining contaminants may still pose a health threat. But back in Front Royal, this comes as good news. Fred Foster believes the Avtex site should be sealed and reused as soon as possible, a prospect which may come true by the end of the year.
And if one thing we should learn that should be a college degree for us, don't ever let it happen again. I think that we can clean up our sites in this country if we would be as aggressive on cleaning up the sites in this country as they were as being aggressive when they polluted them.
Congress and EPA are currently working out the contents of a Superfund reform bill, which may be passed in this session. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
I'm Peter Burley. What do you think about Superfund? Give us a call. Our toll-free number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Our email address is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. Tell us what's on your mind or send us questions you have about the environment. Or visit us on the internet where you can hear The Environment Show anytime. It's at www.enn.com/envshow.
I'm Linda Anderson, and this is Ear to the Ground, with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, doing the swamp thing. About 50 miles northeast of New Orleans lies a once vibrant cypress swamp, the Manshack Swamp. Years of intense logging has denuded the area of its diverse, species-rich wetland forests. By the end of World War II, the swamp was logged out, and since then, little regeneration has occurred. That is, until 1991, when Michael Green, research assistant in biology at Southeastern Louisiana University, led a bunch of students into the swamp. Through the university's Wetlands Restorations Lab, Green says they began experimenting to figure out why regeneration was not occurring naturally.
And we always had to depend upon volunteer help, mostly students from here at SLU, to help us go out and plant. And some of them were kind of draftees from wetlands classes and other ecology classes that we took out there.
Their research, Green says, revealed a number of reasons why trees were not growing.
One of the primary ones is the exotic rodent nutria, which has been introduced from South America to this area in, I believe, around 1925, and it has since spread all across the Gulf states and up and down the east and west coast, for that matter. Another problem was entangling vines, which cover the young seedlings and prevent their access to sunlight. And a third problem was a lack of nutrients being brought into the area because of levee building over the past 100 years or so. It has changed the course of the Mississippi River, and these areas don't get nutrients anymore.
Once the causes were discovered, Green says he needed a good-sized workforce to help plant young cypress in a way that would ensure survival. He got in touch with an organization called the National Alternative Spring Break Program, and now he says he has volunteer students coming from as far as Oregon.
The Alternative Spring Break is kind of an interesting way for them to spend a spring break. They give up sort of the traditional festivities of hanging around on the beach and all that and do something meaningful with their time, whether it be working on homelessness or AIDS patients or working with Habitat for Humanity or, like us, doing some environmental work.
He says the students are highly motivated, work diligently, and take a lot of pride in what they're doing. Or as one SLU graduate student named Rachel explained, the volunteer students are the kind of people who aren't afraid to sweat and sacrifice clean clothing to help restore a wetland ecosystem. Rachel has been volunteering for 3 years and describes a typical student expedition.
It's very muddy, naturally, so we usually wear hip waders or at least shrimp boots, galoshes, to go out there and plant these things. We usually have a belt full of these young cypress trees hanging from our waists, and a spade type device that we plunge into the ground to make the hole in the mud where we plant the cypress tree. And then these PVC pipes are cut in longitudinal sections so that we can wrap them around the young cypress tree and tape them after it's gotten into the ground. And we just do that in a kind of assembly line fashion out in the marsh.
The PVC tubing is used to ward off the nutria, who like to chew the young cypress. commercial nylon weed mats are used to control competing vegetation, and fertilizer is given to last year's saplings. After years of trial and error, Green says they now have a 70 to 80% success rate with planting. This year, Green says, for the first time, cypress seedlings in the Manchac swamp are taller than he is, evidence that a new forest will stand there. For Rachel, the budding cypress are living proof that during her spring break, she did something important to help improve the environment. With Ear to the Ground, I'm Linda Anderson.
We all have places which are special to us. For some, they're city streets. For others, they're deep in the wilderness. In his book, Birtwater, author Scott Thibany presents a picture of the Four Corners area of the Southwest. It's a place which he says takes us beyond ourselves. His book is named after a place on the Navajo Reservation, where at one point he and his brother found themselves working for a sheep herder.
An old man in a cowboy hat walked past a hogan, chanting to himself in a rolling monotone. Jim Sampson was a Navajo singer, a medicine man. My brother and I followed him to the sheep corral. He didn't speak English. John and I didn't speak Navajo. The singer looked at us with a smile that deepened the creases in his face. Facing out, he swept his arm toward a wide expanse of sand and rock. He wore a leather bow guard set with a silver on his left wrist. Forming the shape of the sun with his thumb and forefinger, he swung his arm in an arc over his head. He then reached out with both arms and drew them back to his chest. I took this to mean he wanted us to herd the sheep in that direction and bring them back at noon. Jim Sampson walked off with a smile, singing to himself. Jim and his wife Alice had offered us room and board to take care of their sheep, but no pay. We ate our meals with them and slept in our own hogan. The door faced east to catch the first light from the rising sun. At dawn, I woke to someone pounding on the door. One of the grandchildren had been sent to get us moving. "Eat," he shouted. "My grandmother says eat." John and I pulled on our boots and shambled over to the main house. As we sat down, Alice grabbed a lamb from a cardboard box next to the stove and began to feed it with a bottle. Her hair was pulled back, showing silver earrings. She wore a velveteen overshirt and a skirt cut from satin gathered at the waist. She had cooked a full breakfast for us. A stack of fry bread set next to two bowls of cornmeal mush with fried eggs on the side. The table held even more food than yesterday. We had been told it was the custom to eat everything placed before us. The woman would be offended if we didn't eat what she served. So we dutifully set to work on breakfast, barely managing to finish. Outside, we joined Jim Sampson at the corral. He led his saddled horse to the sheep pen and mounted it as we opened the gate. Again, he sang a low chant as the goats and sheep filed out. The three of us crossed the sweep of high desert at an unhurried pace. The horsemen trailed the herd, moving without wasted effort. Anticipating every move of the sheep, he was right where he needed to be at each moment. He never raised his voice and never got angry at the animals. This was the first lesson he gave us in herding sheep, and the last. A butte, called the Peak Where Wildcats Stretch, broke the horizon. Closer to us, a massive outcrop of sandstone humped above the flats, and a wind-rippled dune slid down the side of a wash. Stiff clumps of yucca and snakeweed anchored the sandy ridges. Riding through the dry beauty of the land, the old man kept singing to himself. Within a few days, John and I had eased into a routine. Each morning, we woke up to what had become a daily ritual. Eat. My grandmother says eat. But now we dreaded the thought of facing another breakfast. The old woman kept serving us more food each morning. Glumly walking to Alice's house, we sat down at the table before six pieces of fry bread, a can of butter, a bowl of mush, a dozen eggs, and a pot of coffee. Enough. We wanted to accommodate their customs, but we just couldn't eat any more. Taking only what food we needed, we left the rest untouched. That night, their son-in-law, Joe, looked puzzled when we apologized for not finishing breakfast. Suddenly, he began to laugh, realizing what had been happening. "No," he said, "don't feel bad." His wife had warned Alice that belladonnas had big appetites, so she better give us plenty to eat. The first morning, she served what she thought were generous portions. We ate everything. She was afraid she wasn't feeding us enough. So she gave us more the next morning, and more the next. Where do they put all that food, she wondered.
Scott Thibany is the author of Birtwater, published by University of Arizona Press. Stay tuned. The Earth Calendar is next. Apple blossoms are at their peak in northern parts of New York State and New England. It's been a cold and damp year, so flowering is more than a week behind its usual schedule. One of the things I like best about the apple trees in flower in the orchard on our farm is that each variety has its own shade of pink. The grass seems greener than any other time of the year, so the apple blossoms stand out in particular contrast. Over the years, we've planted a variety of apples. Some for eating, some for cooking, some for keeping, some just because they were green or yellow, and some just to see that they would grow. While we didn't think about it, without a variety of apples, we wouldn't have any apples at all. Alan Laxo, professor of pomology at the Cornell University Agricultural Experiment Station in Geneva, New York, explains.
The showy flowers of apple are particularly good at attracting insects, and apple does require insect pollination. Apples can't grow from their own pollen fertilizing their own flowers. They have to receive pollen from another variety of apples. So they have to be able to get pollen from a different variety, and that pollen arrives via bees, both wild and then also the domestic honeybees.
Laxo says that if you plant a couple of apple trees in your yard and are in a place where there are no other apple trees or crab apples around, you should plant different varieties. But in case there's any doubt in your mind about what the bee does to the apple blossom, I asked Martin Goffinet, senior research associate in the Department of Horticultural Sciences at Cornell, to tell us.
The female parts of the flower, those parts are called the pistil. And in apple, the tips of the pistil are divided into five little lobes, and those are called stigmas. And it's on those stigmas that pollen has to land, and that stigma becomes a little sticky, and pollen from the other variety, and actually in its own variety, will likely germinate because it's a sugar solution, and pollen grains typically germinate in sugar solutions. And what happens is that much like in animals, we're all familiar with humans, where a sperm cell has to travel to the egg. In things like apple trees, that's not the case. They're actually carried along as sperm nuclei from the place where the pollen's landed. A pollen tube germinates, and there is a pollen tube nucleus that sort of guides the pollen tube down the stigma, down what we call the style, the tubular part of the pistil, down into the seed cavity, to where the what will be seeds, they're called ovules, host the egg cells. Each one of those has an egg cell within it. And that tube is pushes its way down the stigma and comes into close proximity to those egg cells. Meantime, the pollen tube has another nucleus in it called the generative nucleus, and that will divide into two sperm nuclei. And one of those sperm nuclei will penetrate the egg cell and cause fertilization. And after that, we typically need that process to occur before we get apple fruit set.
While we focus on flowers and bees at this time of year, Professor Laxo says the whole process began last summer.
So that the flowers actually begin forming in the little buds back in the previous summer, and then they continue to develop through the fall, and then in the spring they complete their development and actually come out and flower about a month after the beginning of the growth of the tree, the first little bits of green that you can see.
Market specialists tell us that sex helps increase interest in radio programming. I wanted to rhapsodize further on the beauty and color of the apple blossom, but in this Earth calendar, we opted for an explicit description of the way apple fertilization happens, hoping to increase Environment Show ratings. The role of the bees is pretty clear, but it doesn't look as though the birds have anything to do with it. So I guess a discussion about birds and bees can't start in the apple orchard after all. Thanks for listening. This is the Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. This is the Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, what hazardous chemicals are being released in your neighborhood? The EPA gives us the new list. Billboards, are they visual pollution or constitutionally protected speech? We'll talk green about it. And musician Donald Knack practices his art with junk. These stories still ahead on the Environment Show. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has just issued the latest Toxic Release Inventory, or TRI. The report says harmful chemical releases are down 7% from last year. The Clean Air Act requires companies to report what toxics are being released from their plants. This gives environmental and health authorities, as well as private citizens, a means of finding out how much chemical contamination is being emitted in each neighborhood. The latest report states that while overall releases of air toxics are going down, the production of toxic waste is actually going up. This year's toxic release inventory is unique because for the first time it contains information about an additional 286 chemicals that were not included in the past. Lynn Goldman is Assistant Administrator for EPA's Office of Prevention, Pesticides, and Toxic Substances. Her office assembles the TRI.
Well, the exciting thing about this year's release is that for the first time ever, we now have information about the 286 chemicals that we added to the toxic release inventory in 1994. What we did is we nearly doubled the number of chemicals that are on the TRI by adding some of the most toxic chemicals that simply had been missed during the first round.
And did you find anything that surprised you when these data were made available?
Well, yes, there are some very interesting things that we found. First, which is not a surprise, is that the total emissions to the air, the water, the land are continuing to go down, the downward trend that we have now observed steadily since the reporting under TRI began. But second, what we are surprised by is the amount of the waste that is reported is continuing to slowly go up. So that although we see emissions going down, waste is going up. And then within that waste number, what's especially disappointing is that we're not seeing an increase in the more responsible handling of the waste. We're not seeing the increases we would like to see in recycling and in reuse. And a lot of the increase actually seems to be accounted for by either burning or land disposal of the waste.
Goldman says that the new chemicals on the list are hazardous and comprise a lot of risk.
The number one new chemical to be reported was nitrates. And nitrates were especially discharged into surface water, and we know that's particularly where they can be of concern, either because of affecting drinking water or affecting the environment. And another one that was the number two of the new chemicals was in hexane. And that is a solvent that has very important toxicity. It can be toxic to the nervous system. And so I think it's very important to know where the significant sources of a chemical like in hexane are located.
Goldman says hexane is a solvent used in both industrial and food processing applications. The real importance of the TRI, she says, is that with the information it makes available, communities become empowered to act.
What people in a community will be able to see is exactly who is reporting in their community and what are they reporting in the way of releases, how much waste are they generating, all of which is extremely important information if you want to decide what you can do to clean up your community.
With the expansion and publication of the Toxics Release Inventory, the Environmental Protection Agency has put in motion forces to limit pollution that are driven not by administrative order, commonly referred to as command and control, but instead by the polluter's concern about public outrage and the risk of liability. In 1989, shortly after the TRI was first set up, Dick Mahoney, then president and CEO of the Monsanto Company, told me that even though Monsanto's toxic releases were legal, he thought information about the quantities of hazardous substances being released in communities where Monsanto had plants would be extremely damaging to the company. He ordered that by 1992, Monsanto reduce by 90% the level of hazardous emissions which it had been generating in 1987. Monsanto spokesman Larry O'Neill, speaking from St. Louis, Missouri, says the company met that goal and describes what required emissions reporting has done.
Well, the effect of TRI, or of emissions reporting, is to it acts like a spotlight, and it causes a company to step back and think about total emissions from a couple of points of view. Number one, we recognize that the public expects continuous progress, expects fewer emissions, and when we see our total numbers, we know that we have to move in that direction, and we have been moving in that direction. And the other effect is it caused Monsanto and other companies as well to recognize that we've got either raw materials being emitted or going out the door, if you will, and or we have products in the form of waste being emitted or going out the door that we need to recapture and get some value from. And so over the last 5, 7, 10 years, in part because of TRI, we've been working hard to be more creative in redesigning our manufacturing processes to release fewer emissions and to recycle and reuse whenever possible.
We're talking green, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. Today, we're talking about billboards. Are they visual pollution and environmental blight, or constitutionally protected property and speech, or both? If you want to get rid of billboards in your community, what can you do? We want to hear from you. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. Joining me today is Meg McGuire. She's the president of Scenic America, a nonprofit group based in Washington, D.C., whose mission is to preserve and enhance the scenic character of our nation. And Philip Gitlin. He's an attorney with a firm of Whiteman, Osterman & Hanna in Albany, New York. He's the former counsel of New York's Department of Environmental Conservation, and in his private practice, it includes the representation of both municipalities and outdoor advertisers. Unfortunately, the Outdoor Advertising Association of America, which represents the billboard industry, has refused to join us.
Meg McGuire from Scenic America. Let's start with you. What kind of things is your organization doing to control billboards?
Well, Peter, we've just released a study. It's the first study that's been done in a long time to define what the problem is. And we find that there are more than 450,000 billboards on America's federal aid highways alone, and that 5,000 to 15,000 new billboards are going up every year. We did a survey of all the states, and this is the sort of shocking thing that we find. We've already spent, since the Highway Beautification Act was enacted in 1965, this country has spent $250 million removing non-conforming billboards, but they're going up faster, way faster than we're taking them down. So we found that they're proliferating. About 23 states allow tree cutting in front of billboards, that is, public trees on public right-of-way to make for billboard visibility, so you can see the billboards. So we've got trees going down in at least 1,000 locations every year.
Okay. Well, Phil Gitlin, from a legal point of view, why can't we just pass laws banning billboards and be done with it?
Well, Peter, the major issue that seems to get raised by the billboard owners and advertisers is whether or not a ban, an outright ban on billboards or regulation, impermissibly limit free speech protected by the First Amendment to the Constitution. And there's been a lot of lawsuits about the subject. Commercial free speech, meaning advertising, has been found by the United States Supreme Court to be protected, just like non-commercial free speech. But the degree of protection is not as great. And the court has made it pretty clear that states and counties and towns can regulate commercial, meaning advertising speech, if the regulation implements an important government interest and aesthetics has been recognized as being such an interest.
Now, there's also a property issue there. Haven't the billboard folk argued that they have constitutionally protected property rights in these things?
That's right, Peter. The second issue that seems to be raised when there is a ban or regulation on billboards is whether or not the ban or regulation takes private property without just compensation, which is another constitutional principle under the United States Constitution.
Peter, I'd like to say that the courts have upheld the right of municipalities to remove billboards through what's called amortization, letting the billboard company leave its signs up for 5, 8, 20 years.
Long enough to get their money back
and then remove them. But you see, on federal aid highways, the Highway Beautification Act, the so-called Highway Beautification Act, the Billboard Proliferation Act, really, does not permit municipalities to take those signs down if it's on a federal aid highway.
Okay, well, let's go to the phones, because we're going to hear a lot about that. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN, and we're talking about billboards. So let's go to Missouri. Carl, you're talking green on the Environment Show.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm calling from Columbia, Missouri.
How are you?
And this is a very interesting program. We have an incredible problem with billboards in Missouri. Under our state law, which actually complies with the Highway Beautification Act, billboards can be put up virtually anywhere except on residentially zoned property. And one of the big problems we have is in rural and scenic areas where they can put billboards up on unzoned property if there's a commercial activity within 600 or 800 feet of the billboard.
And
so we're seeing these huge, gigantic double-decker billboards going up all over the beautiful state of Missouri. And we can do nothing about it. You know, our state law also prohibits cities from prohibiting new billboards. So the proliferation of signs in Missouri is just unbelievable. And it's to the point where a group has formed to actually start a petition drive to amend Missouri's constitution to reinstate local control of billboards.
Wow. Meg McGuire, does your program have any presence in Missouri? Are you working there?
Yes, we are. We are working in Missouri, and we hope that this citizen initiative is going to be really successful. People are fed up with this. You know, every opinion poll that's done shows that people don't like these. They think there are enough of them up. They're tired of having all this sky trash, all this litter on a stick, clogging up our scenery. Where the caller lives, there's I-70, you can't drive along I-70 from Columbia, Missouri to St. Louis. You can't be out of sight of a billboard except for one small 3-mile stretch along that roadway. And in Florida, going from the state line down to the turnpike, there are 1,000 billboards in 150 miles. It's just litter on a stick.
Well, Carl, it sounds like you've got quite a campaign going and quite a problem. Meg just mentioned Florida, so I'm going to thank you for calling, Carl. And I see we have a caller from Florida. So let's pick up on Bill from Florida. Bill, you're talking green on the Environment Show.
Thank you. I'm from Jacksonville, Florida, and 10 years ago, the city of Jacksonville, through a citizens' initiative, much like what Carl was talking about in Missouri, passed a strong local law banning further construction of billboards in this community and requiring all billboards located along non-federal roads to be removed after a 5-year amortization period. And as a result, there was some subsequent litigation with the industry. We prevailed through various, we have settlement agreements with all of the industry members, and over 1,000 billboards are coming down in our community. 500 are down now. And the ironic thing, and the thing that people just can't believe, is that the billboards that we can't touch are, the reason we can't touch them is because of the Highway Beautification Act. And it's the most bizarre, someone just can't believe that the Lady Bird Act actually prohibits local governments from requiring the amortization of billboards. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's a real, the amazing thing about this, too, you know, is that this is an industry that pays no road user tolls, taxes, or fees. So for a very small permit fee, the billboard gets its whole transmission system free.
Phil, one of the interesting issues that's been raised here is the interface between the municipalities and the Federal Highway Act and so on. In your representation of municipalities dealing with this, how have they approached this, or what do you say to them when they're backed up against a federal highway that may have a separate set of rules?
Well, the way we handled it in Jacksonville, which is the way I would advise other municipalities and counties in this state, is basically, you know, go as far as you can, which is banning construction anywhere, and require removal, if that's the local, you know, jurisdiction's choice, of billboards along non-federal roads, which they can do over a reasonable period of time. And actually, most billboard companies recoup their investment in the first year that the billboard's up. 5 years is almost universally held to be a reasonable period of time.
Phil Gitlin, is this interface between the municipalities and the feds a problem, as you've seen it from a legal perspective?
Well, it's not so much an interface between the...
Let's hear from Phil Gitlin, our lawyer who's on the panel.
Well, Peter, here in New York, it certainly has been, because the federal law does have this unintended consequence, I believe, of limiting what local governments can do along interstate highway corridors. And, of course, the failure to comply with that act threatens the state's share of federal funds for building and maintaining interstate highways. And I do think it's rather ironic, because the use of amortizations has been well recognized. It gives to the owner a period of time to recoup costs, and during that period, the owner winds up having essentially a monopoly, because no one else can construct a billboard in that area. So they really wind up with an economic windfall, which really mitigates against the economic consequence of a ban.
Let me just say that the voters have got an opportunity to fix this federal law, and they've got the opportunity to do it right now. The Senator Jeffords from Vermont being one of the four states that has banned billboard construction, billboard-free state, Senator Jeffords has introduced a bill, the Scenic Highway Protection Act, which would allow municipalities to take back this right, which both of the other people on the line have said this is a constitutional right that municipalities should have, and to stop tree cutting in front of billboards, to end the kind of abuses in the system by enacting a gross revenue tax on this outdoor advertising industry that's getting a completely free ride.
Bill, thanks for your call, and I see that we have a call from way up in New Hampshire. Martha, you're on the air talking green on the Environment Show.
Yes, this is State Representative Martha Fuller Clark calling from Concord, New Hampshire.
Aha, uh-huh, you're in the state legislature.
Yes, I am. And
so
I
you must deal with this all the time.
All the time.
How are the lobbyists? Do you see a lot of outdoor advertising lobbyists?
You're jumping ahead.
Well, when I was a state legislator, they were all over us. But
absolutely.
Don't let me interrupt you.
And let me just say that for the last five sessions here in the New Hampshire legislature, we have had bill after bill which would have permitted the cutting of trees in front of the billboards next to federal-aided highways, despite the fact that when those permits are granted from the New Hampshire Department of DOT, that they reserve the right to retain the vegetation over time.
So let me understand this. This would be legislation to permit trees to be cut down if they get in the way of the billboard.
That's right. That's right. Even though when the advertising agency takes out those permits with the Department of Transportation, they agree and sign a agreement with the Department of Transportation saying that they understand that they have no rights to cut those trees. So they keep coming back every session with this legislation.
And what happens?
And one of the biggest difficulties that we have is the outdoor advertising industry sends in their lobbyists, as you were referring, in full force to lobby all of the 400 state reps and the 24 senators in our state. And why we have succeeded in defeating that legislation, that margin has become narrower and narrower over time. And it does not reflect the attitudes of the residents of New Hampshire. We have a survey that was taken in New Hampshire 2 years ago showing that more than 70% of the residents would like to ban all billboards in New Hampshire and fully support whatever intentions we can put in place to preserve the scenic quality of our federal-aided highway.
Let me play the devil's advocate for a moment and ask our lawyer, Phil Gitlin, why the advertiser shouldn't have a right to have his product seen if he's got it up there and paying to put it out so people can read it.
Well, there isn't any question, Peter, that advertisers have the right of free speech, just like any of the rest of us. But the Supreme Court has made it pretty clear that commercial free speech is not entitled to the same degree of protection as non-commercial free speech. And so government is free to regulate it or ban it if there's an important government purpose, such as aesthetics, if what they do directly advances the interest, such as limiting or prohibiting billboards. And here's the tricky part. If the regulation or the ban has to reach no further than is necessary to implement that interest. And that's where a lot of successful challenges to billboard regulation have prevailed.
I see. Okay. Well, Martha, thanks for your call. And let's go to Virginia. John, you're talking green on the Environment Show.
Yes, I might relate the situation that we've had here in Virginia. I'm a locally elected town council member in Virginia.
We're getting a lot of local government folk. It's great to hear from you.
Well, we're concerned about economic development and the appearances of our community, so it's a problem for us. The billboard industry in Virginia this past session proposed some legislation that would allow the destruction of mature trees in the public right-of-way, publicly owned trees. And also,
this tree issue is a substantial one. I suppose it's a reflection of ecological health. If the trees didn't grow, then people wouldn't be there. Is that?
Well, I guess they don't know the trees grow, but trees in Virginia do grow over time. But they also included a piece of legislation that would allow them to destroy what they described as unsightly trees or ugly trees. And the legislation was portrayed to the General Assembly in Virginia as sort of a housekeeping bill, and it wasn't even made apparent to them that they were talking about, you know, trees that were planted with public money in the public right-of-way and would affect non-conforming billboards and the like.
And so, Meg, do you have any advice to John about how we can fight it when it comes back?
We were certainly involved in that, working very closely with the Virginia Garden Club, and who termed it the Virginia Chainsaw Massacre, exactly what it was destined to be. The Virginia Garden Club put, it was around George Washington's birthday, and they took seedlings, pine seedlings, and gave them to all the state senators and said, George Washington cut down a cherry tree and lived to regret it. And it was very effective. People can do a lot about this issue. They can complain to their municipal officials and say, we want effective billboard control. They can contact their representatives, their congressmen and their senators, and say, you can do something about this issue.
Okay. Well, I'm afraid our time is up. I want to thank you, John. This is an issue that we're going to return to because obviously it is of a great deal of concern. Our guests have been Meg McGuire from Scenic America and Phil Gitlin from the law firm of Whiteman, Osterman & Hanna in Albany, New York. We want to hear from you. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. And you've been listening to Talking Green in the Environment Show. I'm your host, Peter Burley. Musician Donald Mack has just released a new CD called Junk Music, where he plays everything on garbage. He calls it the true world music because it combines two elements common to contemporary society, music and refuse. All performances use junk, like discarded bottles, lumber, newspaper, and sheet metal. This piece is called Mishmash Music. The instruments you hear include sewer pipes, clay flower pots, and automobile taillights.
Mishmash Music by Donald Mack off his CD, Junk Music, released by the Moo Group of Vermont. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-888-49-GREEN and ask for show number 387. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Chartok is the executive producer. Thomas Lally is producer, and Stephanie Goishman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Packard Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.